Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you here on a Wednesday morning, February the 18th, 2026. 2:18:26, 12 coming up on 13 minutes past the hour, and we've been talking about it for quite a while now. It is the full, extended, complete interview, unedited, that I had with President Emeritus of the Ohio State University, Gordon Gee, last Thursday. We talk about everything. You've heard the clips. Now, here comes the full interview, uninterrupted.
Hey, Scott Spears, WGH Talk Radio, and we are on the campus of Ohio State. It's like coming home for me, and we are with a gentleman who I spent a lot of time with here when I went to Ohio State and then got into radio. We did interviews, and we go back so far at this point that I actually have Polaroids of President Gee and I before games and things like that doing interviews. You pull out the old Polaroid pictures. What a pleasure it is to be with former two-time president of The Ohio State University and now President Emeritus, back for another run. A gentleman who is candid, he is honest, he is a great interview. Because of all that, President E. Gordon Gee, Emeritus President Gee, it is a tremendous pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you, Scott. That was that is totally untruthful about me being whatever I am, but I'm really grateful for the opportunity, and I enjoy you. You know, when did you graduate, by the way?
2000.
2000, so we were here together, and we had a good time, and that... those were great years for the university. Today's a great time for the university, too.
You know, it's very interesting. I want to tell this story in front of you because I always tell it about you. When I knew you were coming back, President Gee would come up to Marion, and he'd visit the Marion campus. And they have their own PR people there, and President Gee was always very busy when he was there because everybody wants to meet you. And I would call in, and I'd say, you know, I want to get an interview with President Gee, a few words. And there was one time where you had a really busy schedule that day. And they said, well, Scott, here, we can't fit you in, but you can come and cover the visit. So President Gee was there, and he comes out of the big meeting, and we're going down the hall, and he sees me, and he says, hey, Scott, are you going to interview me? And I said, yeah. He said, let's go into the room and do the interview. And I'm sure they loved you that day. We made the trip a little longer, but that's the type of guy I'll never forget.
Well, thank you, Scott, but you know, I think that you have a job to do, I have a job to do, and we have a job to do together. And, of course, you're such a great supporter of the university and of the state. And you know, and Marion is one of my favorite campuses. You know, I love visiting that place.
Yeah. President Gee, what is it like to be back here? 2026.
Oh, you know, it's like riding a bicycle. How does that sound? You know, you come, all of a sudden you get back into the rhythm. You know, I'm here on short bursts. I'm here for 3 weeks right now. I'm just finishing my third week teaching, kicking tires, talking to people, having a great opportunity to hopefully be of some help, but also to learn. You know, I think that even at my age, I spent 45 years in university prison. There's so much to learn because higher education is changing so much. But this institution has a particularly important role to play in the broader course of higher education right now. And the reason for that is that there's so much turmoil in the body politic, and these great land-grant universities, of which Ohio State is one of the most, if not the most important, really are the people's universities. And I think that they really have the opportunity to reconnect the people, no matter what your politics are, no matter where you are, to reconnect the people to be more engaged in thoughtful discourse.
You know, it's very interesting. I want to get your thoughts on education and how it has changed and where we're headed. But you left here 2013. There was a little controversy at the time.
Ahead of the sheriff.
That's right. Yeah, you know, you.
I left just ahead of the sheriff. I've done that in a number of years. The reason I've had to change jobs so many times.
But then it's your candidness, which you have said. You're a candid gentleman, which we all appreciate in the media. You left here in 2013 after some comments and so on and so forth. But to be invited back 13 years, is there a little redemption in that?
Oh, of course. I mean, there's always the fact that you're still valued and appreciated. You know, I was president of this university twice. And I'm not certain. Very few people have been presidents of universities twice. I was president here twice and president of West Virginia twice. And I always tell everyone I came back in order to be able to undo all the mischief I did the first time, you know. But yeah, it's very reaffirming to still have lots of friends here and people that I really appreciate. And you know, this building we're in right now is the Glenn School of Public Affairs, and John Glenn was such a great friend of mine, and I actually talked him into letting us create this school in his honor, and so that in and of itself is just a real treat. Mm.
Why do you think candidness is not appreciated by all?
Because people have lost their sense of humor. You know, everyone parses out every word, and people are in the business of finding offense rather than in finding joy. And I think that I've just refused to let that be my moniker. I'm not going to walk on eggshells, afraid to say what I think. And you know, it's been really terrific. Since I retired, I feel like I've actually had my First Amendment right restored. Mm. It scares the hell out of people. But I think candor in today's world is very important. You take a look at what's going on, watching the talking heads on television, watching everywhere. Everyone has a point of view rather than trying to come to some sense of truth and power.
Mm. Want to talk a little bit about politics here, because Mary Ellen Withrow, who couldn't be with us today, we hope she can come back in April and we can all get together. But she tells the story that back when she was treasurer of the United States in the 90s, that she called you, wanted you to run for governor at that time. A lot of people have wanted you to run for politics. Why didn't you ever? And would you ever? You're never too late.
Oh yeah, well, I tell you right now, my friend, they'd have to carry me around in a sack or something to get me to do that, you know. But I tell you, I did approach it. I approached it once in Colorado, and then once here. I mean, I really did have a good pathway to the governorship, as you know, and the polls were great. Everything was great, but I in the end, I think that the work I'm doing is very meaningful, and I really appreciate the value of universities, and I appreciate the fact that university presidents and governors can both make immense difference. And I really had a great opportunity to do some good things here, and I wanted to do it.
What do you make of your old friend Coach Tressel being the lieutenant governor?
Oh, I tell you something. Jim is doing great work. I was just with him at the University Council, and he is the same guy. He's just this calm, collected, very thoughtful, very energetic leader. And I think that Ohio is so fortunate to have Jim Tressel.
Why do you think Governor DeWine chose him? A lot of people were surprised by that.
Well, I think Governor DeWine. Don't tell
me we said that.
No. I love Governor DeWine. You know, he's a great friend of mine. But I think that he chose him because he wanted to have someone in that role who could represent the best interests of everyone in the state. And you know, Jim Tressel is an iconic leader. And I thought it was a brilliant choice. I was a little surprised that Coach Tressel took that job because, you know, I mean, he has a lot of things going on. He's very well positioned to do a lot of fun things in his life right now. And that's a very heavy-duty job. And also, he succeeded a great leader, John Husted, who was the lieutenant governor, is one of my favorite people. And certainly someone, I think, who has had an enormous influence on the economic development of the state, and I think that Governor DeWine wanted to have another heavy hitter.
You know, it's very interesting. The night before Jim Tressel announced that he was not going to run for governor because he was thinking about it, we were with Governor DeWine at the Little Brown Jug. We had him on, and it was very clear that Governor DeWine wanted him to run but didn't think he was going to. Would you have liked to have seen Jim Tressel run?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I would have come over, put on a sandwich board, and campaign for him. No, I think Jim would have been a great force of positive change for Ohio. Maybe he'll still run. I don't know, but he certainly has been pretty adamant about it.
And the only other political question before we get into the education, we do have a governor's race coming up in 9 months, Amy Acton and Vivek Ramaswamy. How do you see that?
Well, you know, I think that these are two really smart, able people. I know Amy very well because of her work with health and healthcare. And Amy Acton, my daughter was the Secretary of Health for Louisiana, so held the very same job, but thinks very highly of Amy. I don't know Ramaswamy very well, but I do know that he is a very bright, able fellow. I think that the people of Ohio have good choices of them. That's what's important. You know, sometimes in political races, Scott, what you have is you have a choice between two people who are not really worthy of the office. I think we have two very worthy candidates.
Do you have a favorite in this race?
You know, first of all, that's a great question. I don't know Ramaswamy well enough to be able to say that he's my favorite, and I do know Amy Acton very well, and I've been to World Affair, but I think that right now my best goal is to stay the hell out of Ohio politics.
Might be safe at this point.
Well, it's not about safety, you know. I want to know what positions people are taking.
That's right. That's right.
And I don't vote. I don't vote in the state, although I love the state, and I follow it very closely. And I think that I do think that there's some excellent candidates here.
You know what you just did? A lot of people have a hard time with is saying positive things about both the Republican and the Democrat running for office. Why do you think that's so hard?
I think it's because people have gotten into the corners. They've got, you know, they've gotten convinced that there's only one right road to salvation. In my view, there's a number of very good roads to salvation, and we need to move back into the center. This is the problem, Scott. What we have is we have about 70% of the American public who believe who are basically right of center or left of center. And then we're controlled from the wings. And the danger to our democracy is the fact that those 70% are not really represented. Because if you, in the primaries, because of the way gerrymanderings occur, the way that people only come out in those primaries, you really have a very strong view about everything. Those 70% of those folks are not really represented, and we've got to change that. We've got to get back into an electoral system that allows people to voices to be heard from the very beginning.
You are a very popular personality in Ohio, popular figure. If somebody asked you for an endorsement, if they asked you to campaign for them, would you do it?
If I felt strongly about that individual, yeah, I would. I would. I have no problem. I have, you know, I, as a university president, I rarely endorse for people. I would provide some financial support, et cetera, because I did not think that as a university president, I should be planting my flag in any specific camp. But I'm no longer a university president, and like any individual, I want to exercise my rights.
I want to talk a little bit about your style, because your style sticks out with people, certainly the bow tie. Where, for people who don't know, where did the bow tie come from?
Oh, the bow tie. You know, I grew up in a very small town, Scott, a town of 2,000. We had neither, I always tell this story, we had neither a movie theater, nor did we have television, because television was just not available. And this town was the largest city between Salt Lake City and Denver, called Vernal, Utah, which was the same distances between Charleston, South Carolina, and Boston, Massachusetts. I mean, I really grew up in rural America. I get asked this question all the time. You know, where'd you grow up? And I say, where do you think I grew up? And they say, oh, you know, you're president of these big universities. You grew up in Chicago, New York, or Los Angeles. No. I grew up in a very small town. But my father, in order to get health care, particularly for eye care and that, I'd have to go to either Salt Lake City or Denver. We went to Salt Lake City one day. I was 15. I was getting my eyes examined. A guy sat right next to me. He had one of these bow ties on. And I asked him about it. I never really seen one. And he was very kind. He undid it and showed me kind of how it worked. And I just was fascinated. So I told my dad, I said, we're going right across the street to Arbox, which is the name of the store, and buy a bow tie. Well, there was only one there. I bought it. And that's, the rest is history, you know, because I have continued to wear them. I have over 1,000 active bow ties, and I have another 1,000 in retirement. As I say, I'm making them, or have made some of them, into quilts for my granddaughters.
Oh, very nice. What is it about you? It's hard to step outside of yourself, but clearly people are attracted to you. People like to be around you. People enjoy having you around. What is that? What do you have?
Wow. What a question. Obviously, I think the answer, partially at least, is the fact that I really love people. I mean, I'm a people person. I do this, if you've ever taken the Clifton Strengths tests, where they name all your personality and stuff, are very accurate. My number one characteristic is that I'm a woo, and a woo means that you really like people, you're very engaged with them, and I think that people like people who like people, if that makes sense to you. I mean, you know what I mean. I mean, I was just thinking today, there were the three girls walking across the street, and one of them looked at me and she said, "I just saw your picture." And I said, "Yeah, you probably did." And she said, "Aren't you the former president of Bush?" And I said, "Yes." And we ended up having the greatest chat. One was from Massachusetts, one was from Philadelphia, one was from Nebraska, and you know, I just love the engagement of the human spirit. You know?
Do you have a philosophy?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, my philosophy is that you need to make certain that you have a good deal of humility and that you have a good deal of curiosity. Those are my philosophical underpinnings. I think that so many people rise in stature in certain of these kinds of jobs. I've seen so many university presidents who want to see become university presidents think that they know everything, and they become isolated, they become arrogant, they become disengaged with the general public. You know, you work for the people, no matter where you are. If you're a politician, you work for the people. If you're a university president, I work, you know, here I work for 65,000 students, 50,000 faculty and staff, 11.6 million, I keep wanting to say West Virginian, you know, because the fact that I've been there for quite a while, Ohioans. And, you know, I think recognizing the worth of the individuals who are in your life is so incredibly important.
You have faced loss in your life. How do you get through it?
Yeah, you know, my first wife, Elizabeth, died of breast cancer at age 43 and left me with this wonderful young girl, 15 years of age, Rebecca, who was adopted. Rebecca went on to achieve great things, went on to the Harvard Medical School. She met her husband there. They were on a scooter, married about 18 months, they were on a scooter going to the hospital. They were hit by an SUV, and he was killed, a brilliant young man. And she nearly died at six weeks ago. They were in a hospital and 6 months in rehabilitation. We all have those moments. But what I've learned is that the people that you love the most want you to carry on. And the people that you are with want to be inspired by your resiliency. And I think that those two things are very important. A lot of people just simply can't move on, or they move on in kind of a dreary way. I take a lot of joy out of having the successes that I've had with Elizabeth, my wife, and Rebecca's successes are just extraordinary. But I think that that's a tribute to the loss that we had.
What have you learned from loss?
I think that I've learned that a loss is not fleeting, it's forever. But that it also is something that you need to determine how you best manage in your personal life so the loss does not slop over, to use that terrible word, slop over into the way that you treat other people and to have other people feel that you're constantly mourning. I don't think that's healthy for you or for the people you're with.
A lot of people, no matter how they feel about you, would have the idea, they would find it hard to believe, unimaginable, that you could get angry. Do you get angry?
No, I really don't. I think that anger is a is a bad characteristic. I had a father who never raised his voice, and I took a great deal of pride from learning that from him. But more importantly, you can get really irritated. You can get humiliated. You can get attacked or whatever. But if your response is anger instead of curiosity, if your response is anger instead of asking why did this person do what they did, you're not using it as a learning moment. I think that every moment of life is a moment of learning. When you wake up in the morning, you've learned the fact that you survived another day. Mm. When you read, when you think, when you meet people, and particularly on a university campus, it's a daily seminar. And I think that the whole point about our lives is the fact that we're put on this earth to learn, to be better people, but also to learn to help other people, to learn to make ourselves better, to be more interesting, to be more creative. And everyone is given different circumstances. We're just thinking today about Abraham Lincoln, because you think about him a lot when you're at Land-Grant University, and he had nothing. But yet, he drove himself to learn and did it daily, and I think that that's kind of a great example.
We all think we know everything about you because we've known you for a long time.
Yeah.
What can you tell us that we don't know? What would surprise us?
Oh, I think people would be surprised to know that I love music. I do love music, but they'd be very surprised to know that I love opera. So I grew up in this little small town, and we had no radio, no television, but on Saturday afternoons, there's a clear channel, radio station, KSL. And they would put on Texaco Opera Vieira every Saturday afternoon. So for most kids around the country going to see Roy Rogers or Tom Mitch or whoever it was, I'm aging myself here, I would listen to opera, and I became such a great fan. And I've been to most of the major opera houses in Europe and in Australia, and I've been, I've actually sat through 26 and a half hours of the Ring Cycle by Wagner's Ring Cycle at Bayreuth, where they were put on, nearly killed me, but I did it. And my granddaughters, my identical twin granddaughters, age 13, I'm taking them to the Met in a couple of weeks to see La Traviata.
Mm, very nice.
Yeah.
You know, one thing is interesting. You know how to make the papers.
The papers know how to make.
They certainly do. Even in your brief return here, this stead since January, you've made the news a couple times. What do you think that is? Why is that?
I think I'm an interesting character. You know, I'm unusual. You know, I don't look and act and talk like a university president. I'm not what people think about. You know, I think Ted Carter is a magnificent university president, and he looks the part, and he sort of acts the part. I never did quite figure out how to act that part. I admit it, I have a great sense of humor, sometimes gets me in trouble, but I'm not afraid to laugh at myself and not afraid to talk with people. But I'm just kind of an unusual person, And I think that is both irritating and attractive.
Mm. It's so interesting to me when you appeared again this round that here he is, President Guy, in the newspapers again, and I thought, some things never change.
Yeah, they certainly don't. And as I told everyone, so one of the reasons I'm here is, first of all, President Carter invited me, but the other reason is the fact that they had appointed a wonderful president of West Virginia. And I remember from my own time as university president, very often these old presidents would hang around, and they were just pains in the neck. And so I said, well, I'm going to go into hibernation. And that's what I've done. I was telling today just the story about the fact that when I became the chancellor of Vanderbilt, three of the chancellors, I was a seventh chancellor, and three of the old chancellors were still in my building. But one was 102, one was 95, and one was 85. And they were very harmless because all I had to do was get an artificial respiration. But you need to give people space. I did not get as much space in certain institutions where I've served, and I think it was very difficult.
I want to talk about education, as I said, but I just want to go through a couple of these things that people are talking about. You can say what you want about them, or not what you want about them. You were on WOSU in January, and the quote that everybody is talking about is, you were talking about Les Wexner, who's in the news, and you said, this is cancel culture going wild. If you believe that there is even some scintilla of an issue, sometimes people just want to go to DEF CON 2, that's silly. People got angry about this.
Yeah.
What do you make?
Well, I think that they didn't have a right to get angry. They can get angry because that's what they're good. Because look, people take great pride in seeing people who have achieved great things or have great work to see them fall. And, you know, I know Mr. Wexner very well. I was on his board. He was the chairman of my board here. A few people know him any better, and I can say unequivocally that I think that he is a man of great values and great integrity, and we need to let the process play out. I mean, why would we ever condemn someone because of the fact that they associated with someone else? And we don't know how long the association or whatever thing. So I do believe that we have this cancel culture, and I use it again. You know, people don't see the right thing, then all of a sudden they're a pariah, and people get bullied because of the fact that they don't think we, and that's how people I think they ought to think. The First Amendment is the First Amendment, and we need to reacquaint ourselves as an American public with the First Amendment, which is all about free speech and the ability to be able to think and do and say what we want to say, to be able to be held responsible, but not to be given a characterization in which there is no need to do so. If facts came out that were damning, I think we all know that Jeffrey Epstein was a terrible person. But he knew a lot of people who probably had no idea about all the things he was doing, and I don't think it's fair to condemn everyone who even had a relationship with him just simply because of the fact that he was a terrible person.
And I don't want to get too deep into this because I know there are some legal issues here, but the documentary last year, Surviving Ohio State, came out, and that now is a part of Mr. Wexner's history that he will have to testify in regard to that. Did you watch the documentary? Did you know? What do you just make of that whole story in general?
I think, again, it's one of those things that I look back on, 30 years later, and obviously it's a terrible story, but it was something that if I would have been aware of it, I would have taken care of it. But obviously, in a very complex university, EDOQ, you're not aware of everything. There is no evidence whatsoever that my office do anything about it. This one guy keeps saying that my name is mentioned 33 times in the Perkins School. Probably it is, because I was president of the university. Your name is mentioned when you're the president of the university. I mean, so the fairness factor is very important. But I did not watch it. And I just don't talk about ideas that are being litigated right now.
But you did not know about them.
No.
Yeah. And the other thing, and then we are going to get to education, because that is what I want to talk about here, just happened this week. And maybe this is just wrong place, wrong time, but people wanted to interview you earlier this week. We're taping this on Thursday afternoon. Some people who do blogs, and I think a documentarian, came up to you in a hallway. I think you had come out of the restroom, and a professor here had an altercation with one of those.
Well, yeah, you know, I didn't quite see all of the altercation, but I do know that the bloggers were being extremely aggressive to the point that they were obnoxious. And I think that's not fair, you know what I mean? So I had been teaching a class for 3 hours. I was teaching the class. And so I came out, went to the bathroom, and when I came out, and I was courteous to them. I just talked about civility earlier. I think that the young guy, the young faculty member, they really got in his face, and he was in role playing the Good Samaritan. I'm not condemning anyone, but I am saying that I think that incivility should not be rewarded.
Journalism today, you talked about it in the event that happened this week. What do you make of journalism today that doesn't request an interview like we have done and just meets you in a hallway?
As everything in life, there are really people who are absolutely superb. But what has happened with journalism is the fact it's no longer journalism. Journalism is about seeking the truth, not seeking a political opinion, not enhancing a political opinion. I think, for example, what we're doing right now, you're a great journalist because we had a discussion, you asked tough questions, but you did not put a spin on it that was defensive or offensive. And I think that what is happening so often right now is that the world of journalism, as defined by what would be a good journalism, really does not exist. And I'm talking about from the far right or from the far left. I'm not condemning one side or the other. I'm condemning the fact that I do not know what happened to seeking truth and power.
We've got to get education in here. Where is education headed?
Well, I think right now that we have serious challenges in terms of public education. You know, they're talking about doing away with the Department of Education. And in many ways, I agree with that. And the reason is the fact that they haven't accomplished a great deal. When Ed Bell, who was the first Secretary of Education, came in. He and I were good friends. I was just the new president of West Virginia, and I went and visited him. He said he didn't know why they had either have a Department of Education, because he really felt that that was the state's issues. But we've put $1 trillion into public education over the last 30 or 40 years. We have gone from first and second in the world in terms of achievement to 39th and 40th. So the more money we pour into education, the less results we're getting. We need to have a new formula. We need to have a new way to think about education. We are becoming less and less competitive. And that, for public education, is a terrible role. For higher education, the very same problem is the fact that, you know, I had to laugh at the students at Harvard. The fact that Harvard finally said, you know, we've got to, everyone, 80% of our students are getting A's. That doesn't sound right. And the students had a riot. Well, of course we all should get A's. I mean, as if God foreordained that everyone got an A. This notion of not having standards and expectations is a real drag on the American system.
What's your feeling on student loan debt?
Well, I think that during the Obama administration, when we made it a government program, we probably made a mistake, because people just got loans willy-nilly, and now they've had to, now they're in the process and having to pay it back. I think the student aid is extremely important, because people need to be able to afford going to school, but also universities need to be very conscious, make certain that they just don't, that they don't charge tuition outright without thinking it through carefully. I point out, when I was in President Brown University, I'd wait for Harvard to set his tuition. I do ours $100 less. I mean, that's no way to think about setting tuition. There's no way to do what we should be doing. So financial aid is important. It needs to be done in a very thoughtful way. It doesn't need to be just doled out. But on the other hand, universities need to be very thoughtful about the kind of cost structure that they're providing for students.
Two parting questions, never enough time that we get to spend together. Anything left you still want to do in life?
Oh, yeah, man, gosh, you know, I want to be a better father. I want to be a better grandfather. I want to be a better husband. You know, I want to do all those things. I think right now what I'm very interested in are two things. One, I'd love to be able to solve the problems of college athletics. You know, I'm very involved in it. I was the I was the vice chairman of the college football playoff, and we're in the middle of an existential crisis for college athletics. That's not my highest priority, but I'd like to do that. And the other thing, and I'm really a strong believer in bringing universities into more positive discourse about the work that they're doing. One of the reasons that I'm very interested in these civic institutes is the fact that I believe that they're one way to indicate that we need to have clarity. We still need to believe in the Western canon. We still need to believe in our country in many ways. We still need to, not in many ways, we need to believe in our country. They need to understand its founding, its principles, etc. We need to make it better. You don't do it by tearing it down. We do it by having a conversation. The universities need to be at the center. And there are other things I'd like to do, but, you know, right now, I've got my plate full.
Your plate is full? Finish this sentence. Gordon Gee is.
Gordon Gee is a character. He is a unique human being, as we all are, but he is a character, no doubt about it.
You know, President Gee, it has been so much fun. It has been far too long. I hope you do come on the program more often. Sitting with you is wonderful. I know you know I have to ask tough questions, and I appreciate that you answered them all. And as they would say about people many years ago, and I think it applies to you, you are a classic. President Gordon Gee, President Emeritus, one of my favorite people. Thank you. Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
And that was the interview with President Emeritus Gordon Gee. Well, there, we finally got to it. Phone lines are open. We've got about 11 minutes left in the broadcast if you'd like to comment on that interview. 740-383-9944. That's 740-383-9944. But there was the much ballyhooed Gordon Gee interview. Well, I think we covered all the bases. We talked about student loan debt. We talked about the Department of Education. We talked about the gubernatorial race. We talked a lot about President Gee's personal life, dealing with personal loss, and the clip that you've heard so much this week, the altercation at Ohio State between the cameraman and the professor, as well as Les Wexner, who's in the news, the surviving OSU documentary. I think we went all around the waterfront there. So again, the phone lines are open if you have anything to say in regard to that. We've got about 10 minutes left in the show. 740-383-9944. That's 740-383-9944. And again, I thank President Gee for being on the program. Also thank John Kulowitz, one of the Democratic candidates for Attorney General, who will be in the Democratic primary coming up on May the 5th, Cinco de Mayo. And again, the phone lines are open here with just about exactly 10 minutes left to go today. 51 degrees, cloudy skies in Marion. Hey, that's not bad. 740-383-9944 if you have anything to say. 740-383-9944. Well, last night was City Council committee meetings. It was an interesting time, to say the least, last night at City Council. The conversation turned at one point to the flock cameras that the sheriff's office and the police station use. And Ayers Ratliff and his family were in attendance, former Second Ward City Councilman. And during this conversation, Ayers got up and talked about, and I'm paraphrasing this, but he talked about how badly he thought these things were, that he did not trust law enforcement here in Marion, that he did not trust the chief of police. So it was an interesting moment. City Councilman at large, Dan Clark, defended the sheriff and the chief of police in that moment. Go ahead, caller.
Darren Spears, get on your website and look up the comment that Ayers made.
Well, yeah, you know, I have the audio. I thought it would be on the news this morning, but it's not there yet.
Okay. Well, I actually tuned out, like, the last few minutes of the meeting because The other half worked late last night, otherwise I would have been there. But I tuned out because the flock stuff, it's kind of like, it is what it is. Like, either we're going to get the money for it and keep it going, or we're not. But it doesn't matter. We can all get up there and yell about Fourth Amendment stuff. They don't care. You know what I mean? So I just kind of tuned it out there towards the end. And then I actually turned it off. And then I saw the post on your page, and I was like, what? And I went back and I listened to it, and I was like, damn, Ayers reappeared. I'm calling it his revenge tour. I'm like, he reappeared, and Andy went up there and chewed some serious behind.
Well, it was interesting, and you know, like I said, I didn't want to read it verbatim here, but we do have the audio, so maybe we'll have that tomorrow. It you know, he went up there and said what he said, and then Thad Smith jumped in at one point and said, I don't think that the chief is intimidating. And then Dan Clark gave his speech about how he felt this was Ayers, I forget the word he used.
But well, I've got it here in front of me. It says, so I'm sorry, Mr. Ratliff, I realize that you've just gone through some major trauma with law enforcement in your life. You cannot project that onto the rest of the city. That was an isolated issue. So I think we should congratulate them, blah, blah. But he said it was a one-off. Danny Clark told Ayers Ratliff that his situation was a one-off and that he loved and he would, I mean, I think if Jay McDonald was standing in front of him, he probably would have licked his boot right there in front of everyone.
Well, Jay McDonald was standing right in front of him, and Sheriff Bales was in the back of the room in a seat.
Aww.
Yeah. Well,
the Mutual Admiration Society was in full effect.
Well, it was interesting, and then Ayers did get back up and said, you know, you should have faith in the police department. I had faith in them, but essentially, at some point, you're not going to have faith in them.
And I missed it again. I must have went to sleep. But you know, I had a little thought, and I'm not trying to drag myself into Ayers' trauma, because good God knows I've not been to anything through anything compared to them. But as far as one-offs go, and Danny Clark, boy, it's a good thing I wasn't there last night, because I probably would have lit into him. As far as one-offs in the police department, I live, oh gosh, less than a quarter of a mile away from Ayers, and I have an entire ignored murder confession on my household from the Marion City Police Department. It was given to them first. So how many one-offs do we get before we're allowed to say we don't like the police?
Well, it's very interesting.
If they don't like what we've got to say, Scott, they don't need to be on city council. They need to learn to keep their yaps shut when we get up there and say what we've got to say. He could say, I respect our police and whatever else. Don't put Ayers' name into it. Don't bring his situation into it. And don't call it a one-off, because that man damn near lost everything he owned.
Well, I think the line in Ayers's speech last night was this, I think, that was maybe most profound. He said, we are not above having a police chief that has significant moral problems.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, I, you know, and then I believe he said, we should not fool ourselves that your speaker, we should not fool ourselves that we are above having a police department that has problems. So,
well, clearly it does. I mean, clearly it does. And, I mean, we've got the thing with the mutual aid where they were passing ordinances. They don't have the money to keep their own SWAT cameras going, so how long before they come asking for a handout on that? You know, they've got all of this stuff and all of these ways to control and all of these ways to spend money and all of these ways to screw people over. Now I'm hearing, okay, I woke up this morning to a letter in my inbox that Joel Spitzer had sent to, he's an attorney here in Marion. He's been hired by the police officer who's sitting in jail that's accused of rape. There's a letter from Spitzer to Grogan. Spitzer wants to address the grand jury because he says he has proof that this guy is innocent. So is this going to turn into another Ratliff situation?
Well,
another one-off?
You know, if that is true, I would hope that Mr. Spitzer would contact us here, and not that contacting you was a bad thing, but
no,
that he would contact us, and we could hear this, because, You know, I think people do need to know this sort of thing and what it is, and then they can make their mind up for themselves if the officer is innocent. But, you know, that's a heavy-duty claim to make right off the go here. Just,
why don't you contact Stitcher for a comment?
I have.
Oh, cool.
I have. So if I hear back from, encourage him to respond. So,
Scott, I woke up to this at 4:45 this morning.
Well, I knew something was coming last night. I'll just say that. I knew something was coming last night. And I knew it was in regard to that. I just, at that point last night, we were working on this story and so on and so forth.
Well, you know, if I think at this point, just to remove all doubt after everything that happened with the Ratliff trial, if we got such an air situation to where this guy should have been indicted in been arrested in a day or two, because it's another one of those situations. You know what, Scott? Gosh, I never thought I'd be giving the benefit of the doubt to a rapist who also happens to be a police officer. Those are like almost two of my least favorite things in the world.
And well,
here I am wondering if what's being said is really true, the fact that I can't believe what comes out of our prosecutor's office after the Ratliff situation.
Well, you know, there was a conversation last night after the meeting, and maybe I'll leave the phone lines open tomorrow to get into a lot of this, and maybe I'll hear from Mr. Spitzer today, and we can talk about that. But there's a whole lot of stuff going on here right now. The fallout from this police officer rape allegation, and then we've got, and I'm going to say this in the kindest way, And I don't know what's wrong with the water. Let me be clear about this.
Yeah.
I am not saying
debacle. Let's call it the debacle.
But I am not saying that it's bad water, and I'm not saying it's good water. All I'm saying is,
right. How's that?
Well, there is no evidence at this point that it's bad. Now, if that should present itself, then we'll discuss that. But
let's say it's different than normal.
Different than normal. But what I do find very interesting, and this is a much broader conversation that maybe we'll be have tomorrow, is that the people speaking up most vigorously about this are politicians. And I don't know about that. I think that when a politician takes an issue that they have no proof of,
exactly,
and says, hey, yeah, to me, that looks like they're using it for political gain. And just let me say, there's no one person who's doing this. So the person
I asked 2 weeks ago about the water, though. What could we do legally? Remember? And we weren't there yet. You were there at City Council. I asked Mark Russell.
Right.
You know, if this keeps happening, what can we do? Well, we aren't there yet, but there are things that we can do. Now, all of a sudden, Ray Grogan's making a press release about it.
Well, Ray Grogan did make a press release about it yesterday, but he's not the only one who's done this.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Well, there's somebody else who, off the top of my head, who has talked about this water situation as if they have some evidence or are doing things. And you know what? That's fine if you want to do it, if it makes people happy. But what I always wonder, if you're a politician and you do that, what stops you from doing that in private? Why do you have to do that in public?
Come back when it's fixed and tell us, hey, look what I did without you even knowing.
There's always something about that.
That would buy some goodwill in my book. Fix it and then be like, hey, I did this while no one was paying attention.
Well, think if you're the person who found out that there was something really wrong with the water. You know what I can't figure out? Aqua has said on many different occasions, they have explained the problem, and they have said, we're testing it every 2 hours. Has anybody asked for the tests? I'm sure they would give them to people. Why does...
Would we understand them if we did?
Well, that's the point. We probably wouldn't, but I don't think Aqua would risk a lawsuit of high degree by lying, and this is why I don't think they're lying, and saying, oh, we're testing it every 2 hours when they're really not, or it's bad.
I believe it's within the legal limits. I just don't believe we are all used to what's within the legal limits.
That's probably right. That's probably very well said. And that's what I don't, when people are talking EPA, isn't AQUA, haven't they already said they've contacted the EPA?
Oh, yes. They care more about what the EPA has to say than what Ray Grogan has to say.
Well, I just don't understand that, and maybe somebody should explain it to me. I think it's scary, as much as if somebody would come on and say there's absolutely nothing wrong with the water. I
that
think
we're
it's
politicizing our drinking water.
Well,
yes,
I think
very
it's
scary.
I think it's scary that somebody would say that there absolutely is something wrong with the water. I mean, does it stink at points? Yes. Does it have a funny
overgrowth of natural bacteria? That the only thing they can do is keep adding these chemicals. What are you supposed to do with natural bacteria in a river or lake or holding pond or whatever? It's algae.
I mean, I don't, we'll talk more about this tomorrow and hopefully about the police.
It's time to go.
Thanks for calling.
Bye, Scott.
Bye-bye. Never enough time to talk, but we're coming back tomorrow. Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Doesn't it just? I never thought of that, but you're quite right.